Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of Kyle and Patrick's Yet to Be Named podcast. One plan we potentially discussed for, well, we did discuss it for potentially naming the podcast, was selling it to the highest bidder.
Yes. I still think we should do that. I'm on board.
No, I thought it was a pretty good idea. Whether we end up with the, you know, the East Coast Dyes podcast with featuring Kyle and Patrick, maybe the Under Armour Lacrosse podcast featuring Kyle and Patrick.
Yeah, or even the Warrior Lacrosse podcast featuring Kyle and Patrick.
The Warrior Brian and New Balance Lacrosse podcast.
Yeah, even the STX podcast, the True Lacrosse, the Epic podcast. I mean, we could go in a lot of different directions for sponsorship.
The String King Lacrosse podcast, yeah. Throne Lacrosse podcast.
What else? What other companies? What other companies? Quick.
Fire Threads.
Got it.
Adidas Lacrosse podcast.
Wolf Athletics. We did do it. You said Adidas. I think we got everybody. So hopefully someone will reach out to the right people. And by the right people, I mean Patrick, not me, to fiscally solve our dilemma of podcast naming rights. But we should mention...
Do you mean me?
Well, no.
Are you sure?
They should just DM you. They slide into your DMs. Just slide into Patrick's DMs, guys. Okay. We should tell you guys right up front after our little naming intro. I'm Kyle Devitt. I am the gear and lifestyle editor at Inside the Cross. He's Patrick McEwen, a.k.a. Lax Film Room, just for if this is your first time listening. We did record a podcast earlier in the week.
We did. We talked all about MLL.
We did. We talked all MLL. You're not going to hear that podcast. And that's not because of powers that be editing us. That's me editing myself.
Which really tells you the kind of things that were said on that podcast.
I'm going to go so far as to say it was vicious. Probably the most vicious and impassioned thing
that's
I've ever done.
I don't know about vicious. It was very impassioned. It got kind of emotional. I would say
it got really emotional. I actually taped it while I was in Baltimore. I'm back home in the Shire now. And I taped it in Baltimore and I came out of the office and I saw like all these people that working in the office just like had their eyes wide. Like, what did you just do? What did you just do? We could hear you the whole time, you know? And it was kind of like, well, if you could hear me and I had the door closed and I can never hear Matt Kinnear when he's in there, that's bad. So that's when I went back and listened to a couple of things. I had someone else listen to it. And the consensus was too much of everything. So apologies for the late pod this week. But I think I'm in a better headspace now. Patrick is probably ready to talk more since it was like 80% of me just ranting.
Yeah, it was by far the least I have ever talked on a podcast.
Right.
Which is, for people who know me in real life, it would be a very surprised that I ever was in a situation where I couldn't get enough words in.
Yeah, one of the things that I believe Jeff Shannon said, one of the editors at Inside the Cross, was like, did Patrick talk at all on your podcast, or were you just yelling the entire time? And we'll get to, like, the stuff. We'll cover, like, a little bit of the stuff that I talked about. I'm not going to completely ignore all of it, but I think that going forward, when something really fires me up, I probably shouldn't jump on a podcast like the next day. It's probably not a good idea.
No, you should. We should just edit it very carefully.
Right. There was just too much to edit in that.
There was some good stuff. There was some good stuff there. I think people, it's one of those things too, that in your writing and when you tweet about the MLL, people don't understand how much you care.
Yeah. I mean,
and that came across in the podcast. That's why it ended up the way it did.
Yeah, but it was too much. And that's, you know, if I have a failing in life is that I care too much about the wrong stuff. Hopefully we'll get to just my recap. I wrote a couple more pieces, follow-up pieces to Champ Weekend. Congratulations to the Denver Outlaws for winning the 2016 championship in spectacular fashion. But I think we're going to start out with a little gear talk because we're heading into the Gear Christmas that's coming, and it comes in like September, October, and it's very exciting.
Yeah, I guess we're talking heading into fall ball. One thing that you've noticed, you've seen some rumors of stuff, I'm sure, if you pay attention on social media, of new gear that's coming out. But you've also seen a couple of different heads that you're probably familiar with who have been starting to be marked down a little bit from maybe that $90 to $100 range down to more like $75 or $80, which is what – you want to explain to people what that is a sign of, Kyle?
Usually that's a sign that the head is either being discontinued. If it's a deep decrease, it's usually the head being discontinued. If it's a minor – tweak to the price point, usually like $10 to $15, something like that. It means that the head's still going to be available, but when you buy the version of it the next year, it's going to be unchanged and lowered in the tier. Because I think a lot of people don't realize that, especially the larger companies like Brian, Warrior, STX, they have a tiered system of heads
that isn't just beginner advanced. Right? So you have
new heads are all basically advanced. It's very rare that you see a beginner head, you know, introduced every year. And I don't think anyone does it every year. But you'll rarely see that, and you'll always see a top-of-the-line head being introduced. And that's because, you know, advances in technology, R&D, and also pushing new product. New product demands a premium price point. So you'll see a lot of these newer heads that are coming out will be in the $100 range, $90 range, and that will be kind of the benchmark for that particular company's stance on that head going forward for at least a year. A lot of heads are in like a 2-year, 3-year cycle. So I think the best representation of this is actually how STX has done things traditionally, which is they introduce a head at a high price point. Like people forget the Superpower, the STX, the original Superpower, not the Superpower Plus. The Superpower was a top-of-the-line head that was $90 like 5 years ago, right? You can still buy that head from STX, brand new, and it's $75 or $70, depending on where you're buying it from, right? It's in that mid-range price point. It no longer occupies the highest price point. So what you'll see is actually the Superpower Plus is a sequel to that head, and that's the higher price. That's a $90 price point, right? So that's the high end of that style of head, given even though it has totally different technology, just a similar design, is a premium, right? So you'll see heads from STX. I mean, I'll tell you what, I strung a STX Deuce today with traditional, and I think the Deuce is like at least 10 years old as a head.
Yeah,
but up till this year,
I remember that coming out when
you could still buy that like new from STX as of last year. I believe it's finally discontinued. But the way that they kind of tier their designs and systems is to introduce a head at a high price point, and then, you know, they keep it if it's a good seller or if it's got a good reception, and they just cycle it down. So it's a constant cycling down of their product, which, you know, is great for people that fall in love with a head. They can keep buying it and keep buying it and keep buying it. And also for people that want to try the next version of that head, I guess there's two famous examples of heads just constantly being remade. And that's the first one is the Brian Edge. And the second one is the Brian Clutch. I mean, how many clutches have there been? 12, 14,
maybe
so many versions.
Certainly. We're at the Clutch. Four of them have numbers, but then you have like the Elite and the Super Light and the, when you count X specs versus high school specs.
So many versions. There's just so many versions of the same head that has the thing that's the most similar about them is the face shape and the sidewall. That it's a defining characteristic of a head to have a certain flare on the face shape and to have a certain sidewall strut design. Right? So the Clutch strut.
The bottom rail.
Right. I mean, bottom rail is actually technically like a term that another company uses, but like it's not really a quote unquote design term that's fully, you know, accepted.
Yeah, but I guess, I mean, we
point of offset, I think, is a better way of saying that. And even that's kind of, well, offset isn't really trademarked anymore. So I guess we can say that, right?
Yeah, no, but I guess it's more, there's a clutch shape to the bottom rail, though.
Sure. That's fair. I mean, like I said, point of offset from the shaft, I think, is what differentiates a lot of heads looking at them from the side and looking at the sidewall, as well as the physical manifestation of the struts and what it actually looks like that helps define the head. So I think, you know, a lot of people are confused. Why does Brian keep doing the clutches? Why does Warrior keep doing Evos? Or Evos. Well,
I think the end,
I'm an
though.
Evo guy. Wait,
no, we should talk. We need to talk about the end.
No,
we
will.
Talk about
hold
the
on,
edge,
one second. One second. So,
okay,
there are people out there, and I know I'm wrong when I say this, and I don't care. I say Evo like Magneto. Okay, I like saying Evo. I know it's wrong. I know you don't say evolution. I know you say evolution. I know a lot of people say Evo. A lot of people look at me funny when I say Evo. It's just more fun to say. I just want to acknowledge that, because as we go forward, I'm going to keep saying Evo. I'm never going to stop. I just want you to know. But you launch into your edge rant. Go.
Oh, it's not an edge rant. It's just, I think it's just, it's amusing that the edge was the first offset head.
Correct.
So, really, when you think about it, that's sort of, the offset head was a technology advancement that sort of, that defines sort of the modern head era.
Right.
So to speak. So it's functionally really the oldest possible head that you could conceivably still use in a game today.
And who was using it?
And it what?
And who was using it?
Well, I forget who it was, but it was being used in the MLB Championship game.
Right.
Last weekend.
Absolutely. I still have one.
I
still have five.
One of the Denver defenders was using it.
I think it was Bocklet. Was it Bocklet?
It might have been. I honestly couldn't tell you.
That might have been
was.
The updated one, though. I don't think that was the... I think that was the X-Spec version they came out with, like, 8 years ago. I don't think that was the original, like, OG.
Okay, that's fair. That's fair. But it didn't get changed that much.
No, it's like the same design with like a couple extra stringing holes for the most part and a different backside flare.
Yeah.
For sure. I mean,
yeah, but I know I just am always amused that it's a 20-year-old head that's still being used as a gamer today.
Well, what other technology has advanced heads besides different? I mean, there is no other thing that matches the offset. Nothing. Nothing's
no,
close.
No, there isn't.
Right?
No, not at all.
I think the only thing you could say or better, and I don't think this is true for all the heads or all the companies for that matter, is the material might be a little better now. That's available. Not necessarily being made with, but it's available.
It is if they want it to be. I don't think anybody's disclosing exactly what their blend of you know, nylon resins they're using in their heads, but I'm sure there's been advancements in the last 20 years.
Right. So
it's just a question of how many of them are using.
So you're an engineering guy. I'm a as far as we're talking, I'm analog and you're digital when it comes to design stuff. So why don't you kind of talk about, you know, why there hasn't been advancement in actual design other than superfluous stuff and really materials?
I mean, I don't want to necessarily say that there hasn't been advancements. I think the heads today are better, noticeably better than the heads from 10, 15 years
ago. But why? Why are they better?
I think they're lighter.
Okay.
That's a big one. I don't think I think it's to a certain extent, it's not, not there's been any major leaps like the offset head. It's more just that I think companies, especially as the market has gotten more competitive, that there's now more of a pressure. The little things matter more than they did in the past.
So, give me an example of that.
We should look at the design of the sidewalls. That in the past they sort of used to design them to kind of try to look cool,
right?
Because weight didn't really matter.
Yep.
And stiffness wasn't a huge concern. And so it was sort of just trying to create a cool look more than it was designing for function. And now the sort of the pressure of kids who I don't want to play with a head that weighs more than 5 ounces, which is a ridiculous thing to say, but that sort of thing in the market, kids want to know, you know, is this one 4.9 ounces versus 5.2? That head's lighter, that's why I'm going to use that one. That sort of pressure on them to design more for function over style has led to, you know, you'll see it's sort of it's the the basic sort of sidewall that that Maverick uses, that the String King Mark One uses, where it's just kind of that generic looking sloping sidewall rail that you've seen more and more of over the years, and less like nobody's writing, you know, USA in the sidewall anymore.
Right. No one's. Well, the funny thing is, for people that don't remember, I don't even think you would remember this. I mean, I'm sure you've seen one of these, but STX had a head called the Turbo. And the Turbo has STX as one of the sidewalls, like the letters STX, right?
Yeah, that's. I mean, I was referencing the Warrior Patriot, the one that has USA written
that's,
on the side.
That's the I believe the third gen of that. The first gen of the Warrior heads to come out, the Diablo, the Cobra, and the man. Oh, people are going to be yelling at the. Well, like five people that know gear are going to be yelling at the podcast. But anyway, their first generation, the Cobra, actually had the Warrior W. And it was a weird design. It was a full curve, right? It had the Warrior W in the sidewall.
I remember that.
It was tiny.
You're right. That was.
It was tiny, but it was there.
That was like a weird.
And that was
curve.
A big thing. You know, you see companies that have. I think the one cool design element that stayed is almost all of the heads that are still made today have the company logo or name on the throat, which is like interesting. It's like either a stamp or like a raised print, or even, I mean, in the case of Maverick heads, it's the jewel logo. That is just there.
Yeah, no, there's some Warrior heads that have had that as well. Brian has right. that. If you look at the new Dictators have like a plastic jewel. Kind
yeah,
of
it
thing
has the
there.
King the Brian King logo that they've appropriated.
Yeah,
I think that kind of thing is interesting as far as design elements go. But I think the one thing that has changed that almost matches the offset. The only thing it doesn't really. But it, because good stringers who get around it, is the amount of string holes. Like, if you don't have 18 string holes on your head, no one cares. Like, people are going to, like, criticize your head. When I grew up playing, I had, like, 8 sidewall holes. I didn't know what to do.
Oh, there's something even worse. I was restringing an old Brian shotgun, which is the first head that I ever owned. It has 5.
Wow.
That includes, like, you have to start it in one, then you have 3, and then the one where you finish it.
Yeah. I mean, the struggle is real, guys. You didn't know. You didn't even know. Go on eBay and check out a head that looks really old and buy it for like $5 and see if you can string it with modern techniques. I mean, it's actually really difficult. So I think that's one of the things that has definitely evolved. And part of that evolution has lent itself to the actual lack of increase in design elements, right? Because really, if you throw a bunch of sidewall holes on your head – and you have it be a certain level of stiffness, and you have the weight correct. What else do you need to sell the head?
The face shape.
What else do you need to sell the head?
The X-Spec.
X-Spec limits you so greatly. It limits, like, what your design capabilities so much. What do you have to put out there? Especially now that, really, I mean, high school, we talked about this before, high school spec heads aren't going to be in the picture. I think as of last year, I think all the heads coming out are X-Spec.
Yeah, the heads last year, some of them, like the ones that were released, like the newest Clutch still comes in a high school spec and an
right.
X-Spec.
Clutch 4.
And I think like the RB3-1 came in an X-Spec.
Regulator
and,
came in an X in high school.
Yes, the regulator did. The Evo 4 did, but I think you're right. Like the Evo 5 is not going to come.
I haven't seen the paperwork on it yet. I would assume that it won't, just because it doesn't.
I can't
make
imagine
sense.
There's only one. It's one more year.
Yeah,
you're selling heads, where it's going to be only legal for one more year, aside from the MLL and men's.
Right, and that's the thing too. The thing about we're talking specifically about heads here. Heads can succeed and fail, like very easily. The thing is, companies also want to keep heads around, and this goes back to the cycling thing we talked about earlier. Companies want to keep heads around as long as they're making money with them, right? So the best example of this that you can buy now, a head that's like, I believe it's got to be 15 years old. Do you know what it is? Can you guess? That you can still buy? And everyone uses?
It's one of the versions of like the Excalibur, the X2 by STX?
No.
That's right.
It's wrong because it's not the same head. The exact same head that came out 15 years ago that you can buy now. Think outside the box a little bit. You know what it is? This is fun.
I give up.
STX Eclipse. And yes, goalie heads count.
Oh, you're right. Yeah.
I mean, how have we not had an Eclipse 2? You know why? Because it still makes crazy buckets of money. Everyone grows up playing with it.
It was so good. It's still like widely considered to be the best goalie head.
Sure. It's not actually the most used goalie head. That's probably the – actually also goes to the STX. The Goalmaster was around, which is now known as they rebranded that head. That STX rebranded that as their beginner goalie head. They call it something else now. They don't call it a Goalmaster. Don't remember off the top of my head. Anyway, the Eclipse is the best example of heads not really needing. You know, if you do make the perfect head and it keeps selling and everyone grows up playing with it, I mean, you keep buying the same head.
But also, I feel like aren't goalie heads are sort of a different animal, though, because you're inherently limited in the number that you can sell.
Oh, absolutely. That's why there isn't a lot of goalie heads on the market. I mean, how many companies have more than one? And if they do have more than one, it's because they upped tech or something. Like Warrior has like maybe what, three versions of the Nemesis, counting the Nemesis Light. And that's really the only other head that they've developed past, you know, the first gen. I mean, you could avoid Void Light earlier in 2000.
To a certain extent, from a financial perspective, I've always thought that aren't companies really only making goalie heads because they sort of have to have one to round out their gear offerings?
Yes, to their sponsored teams. That's a big part of it. Yes, yes.
Because it's almost difficult to imagine they're selling enough of them to really be making money.
Well, in the case of like something like the Eclipse, where like every goalie in the past 20 years or 15 years has used an Eclipse at some point, I would be shocked if I met a goalie, even a kid. Like an eighth grader that has never used an Eclipse, I would be shocked. I really would, because the proliferation of that head and design of that head and the tricks that people use, this is underrated. The tricks that people use to string that head, you know, have been developed for years.
That's true. That's a good point, especially because goalie heads aren't as commonly strung as other heads.
Yeah, and I mean they really are, and also the techniques in stringing goalie heads are actually a little more nuanced. No offense, stringers, don't get mad. They're more nuanced than stringing a regular head. As a regular head, you can just lock down 4 or 5 diamonds, string singles all the way rest of the down your head, and you have a good pocket. Like, that's why I always say that, like, stringing a head with mesh is like, you know, a monkey can do that. Like, anyone can do that.
It's not rocket science.
It's not hard. But stringing a goalie head, I think, is difficult.
Having dabbled in some nuclear physics, I can tell you it's nowhere near.
Yeah, it's probably not even algebra, really. Right? Was that a math joke? Math joke.
No,
nailed it. Not really.
Did you? What was the joke?
I didn't nail it. That's why I yelled "nailed it." Come on, Patrick, work with me.
Oh, then I did not get your joke
at
all. Right. Sorry,
that happens. That's why we're on a podcast together. We don't get each other's jokes. Is that
why we do this?
It's funny. So people that are, you know, the business of gear, the new stuff coming out, it comes out in the fall because you want to have it ready and you want to have all your marketing out there for at least a couple months for Black Friday and the holidays, right? That's really why the gear cycle is the way it is, even though the season isn't until March for most players, if not February for college players.
Yes, but I think a lot of it gets given as Christmas gifts because it's right there before the season.
And it's also expensive. Lacrosse equipment's expensive.
Right. Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, that's what always happened when I was growing up. That was sort of the standard cycle was like in the fall that, you know, it used to be before the internet. Well, not before the internet, but before most of this stuff happened online. You'd get the catalogs would show up in the mail in the fall with all the new gear in September, October, and you'd look at it and figure out what you wanted and then tell your parents in, you know, late October, November, you add it to the Christmas shopping list and you get it at Christmas to play.
I used to circle what I wanted and then rank it with a number and like leave it on my parents' like under their pillow. That was my move. That was my move with the catalogs. But actually, so that's interesting. You got a lot of your gear at Christmas. I got a lot of my gear at Christmas as well. What was the best Christmas lacrosse gift that you got? Like, what was the thing that made you the most excited?
It was definitely the original Evo.
Really?
Back when they actually called it the Evolution.
Yes, way back.
I should say I got an Evolution.
Yeah.
When I was in seventh okay. grade.
Mine was, I got one of the first STX titanium long poles, and I got two. I actually didn't want these. I was excited because I had two lacrosse sticks. I'd never had two in my life, and I grew up as a long pole, and I just broke stuff all the time because back in the day, like, stuff was way less durable as far as shaft technology went, and titanium was the standard. Now it's like, oh, that's so heavy. Yeah, you get in the weight room, kids. Sorry, old man rant. Get off my lawn. The other thing I got two Revos, and I wanted Evos.
That was the Revolution.
I wanted Evos so bad. My favorite stick is still the first gen Evo, which is like impossible to string right now. With modern techniques, it's actually a really difficult head to string. And they all break now because the plastic is so old. But that was the head I wanted. But I was still so excited to have two heads.
Mine broke too. I was so upset when that happened. When my original Evolution broke.
I broke one of my favorite. I had an Evo all the way through college, and I broke it on the shoulder of a Tufts defenseman playing crow art in Boston when I was coaching at Emerson in like 2009, and I legit almost cried. It was like my favorite stick. It was perfect. It threw perfect. My friend strung it for me. I didn't even string it. Man, I love that thing. I love that and an orange superpower, which I've written about several times. It's funny. Like, so I'm the gear editor, right? And everyone thinks like, oh, well, that must be like the coolest job, like, you know, to just see and test new stuff. And listen, it is. I'm not saying it's not. The thing that is crazy is that I get to see all this stuff. And some of it doesn't even come out, and it's really frustrating to not talk about. Like, I kind of talked to you about something that I probably wasn't supposed to talk to you about earlier in the podcast, or before we started. And there's also all this other stuff coming out, and I'm, like, sitting here, like, shaking, like, being so excited about new stuff coming out. So hopefully, like, if you have that feeling and you're listening to this podcast, this is the podcast for you. Like, keep listening. Because, like, yes, Patrick likes gear. I love gear. Like, I love it. I love it as like a thing. I love it probably more than the MLL, because I know gear will always be there. I don't know if the MLL is always going to be there, but I love gear.
Pro, I think we're at the point where pro lacrosse is always going to be there.
Are we? Can we talk about that? Do you want to transition?
Yeah. Let's. This makes a good segue into
Great
the MLL.
Segue.
Yeah. There's so much. The sport has grown enough that the gear companies need people to endorse their gear and to use it and to be able to use them in their ads. And as long as they can't use college players, that's a huge monetary incentive for pro lacrosse to exist.
That's a really good argument. I think people getting paid to play lacrosse is going to be there for a long time. Whether or not that's right, the MLL.
That's functionally that's all pro lacrosse.
Let's make a very specific statement then. Pro outdoor lacrosse, that'll be there because that's what grows the most and that's what people invest in the most, because when you invest in lacrosse, you don't invest in the present. Because the present...
No, you're investing in the future
of a very exciting, very great sport. I'm not disparaging lacrosse at all. I love lacrosse. Lacrosse helped build my whole life, save my life. I love lacrosse. But it's not football. It's not baseball. It's not even hockey. And I think the people that are super passionate about the sport think that it is, and it's not. I think there needs to be a little more of a realistic bend to that. And it's ironic that I say that, because one of the things I'm going to talk about the MLL is holding the MLL to a standard. And that's really kind of where I got in trouble last week. I think I'm measured in what I'm going to say this week. I'm ready. I'm ready this time.
Okay. Do we want to go this first before we talk about like the MLL sure. championship? Okay. Keep going.
I'm good. We can talk about the MLL championship. It's just going to lead right into it. Go for it.
Okay. So, I mean, the MLS Championship game obviously was won by the Outlaws, who, not that I dislike the Outlaws, but unfortunately defeated my home state, Ohio Machine, in that game. In a game that was suspended, I think it's going to be forever known as, I guess, is there a name for it yet? Rain, but it's sort of the puddle game.
The lightning game? I don't know.
The lightning
game? Yeah, we haven't coined a term yet, no.
Other games will be suspended due to lightning, but I'm not sure how many of them will ever be played in 2 inches of standing water.
Again. Not on a natural grass field.
Hopefully zero.
Not on a natural grass field, they won't. And okay, so now that we've gotten to that, I'm going to get into my stance on this. I talked to our publisher, Terry Foy, about my stance on whether or not the game should be played. My stance has not changed. One of the things we talked about is I called a lot of attention to the conditions. I believe 8 tweets were specifically either photos or mentioning the fact that the conditions were unsafe. It's been suggested I should have done less, but I felt like it was my job to inform people of what was going on at the time because they weren't, you know, it wasn't a live coverage, people squeegeeing the field on CBS Sportsnet, right? I'm just assuming that it's not what happened. Right? It was like during the delay, what were they showing? They weren't showing the field.
Like during the delay itself, they were showing surfing. But they showed, I mean, when they came back, they showed guys squeegeeing off the field.
So
they showed it a little bit in halftime.
And that was a continuous process. They were also using leaf blowers to dry the water and push the water, which I didn't really understand. But anyway, I maintain this fact, and this is my one point that I'm going to stay behind. I'm going to die on this hill. Ready? There's zero chance that game gets played if it's an NCAA game.
Oh, well, I mean, we saw that. It didn't when it was the ACC championship game.
Right.
They moved it.
Right. But the point of contention I'm trying to make is that the contest is what matters in NCAA, as well as a bunch of other things, and obviously like sponsors and stuff, and they lost out on some money there. But in the MLL, and the other thing that matters there is that player safety is taken into account. And I don't believe that it was in the best interests of those two teams' safety to play the game in those positions and because of conditions. Now, you can dispute that all you want, and I'm ready to debate and happy to talk to anybody that was actually there. If you weren't there and you saw it on TV, your opinion is less valid because you did not experience stepping onto the field and like having your foot sink and having your brand new Nike Flyknits ruined. Okay? I'm not saying like, you know, someone owes me new shoes, but
happened.
I mean, listen, it happened, okay? I'm a little bit of a shoe guy. Maybe you guys don't know that. I was upset. Either way, doesn't matter. I don't think that it should have been played. However, the game was played. The players put on an amazing performance. And kind of as a result of that amazing performance, I feel like people are glossing over the fact that it was an unsafe environment to play a lacrosse game. I'm not going to harp on it
that's a great point that I think the players did such a good job putting on a show of a display of great lacrosse in those conditions that I think, yeah, you're right, that it did minimize how bad they actually were.
It absolutely did. I mean, even after the game, you're still taking steps and sinking into, you know, and I'm just walking onto the field and I'm sinking into puddles all the way up to the bottom of my ankle. I mean, I can't imagine playing lacrosse in a condition like that. I mean, it's how do I say this? I'm getting worked up again. I'm trying not to get as worked up this time. I just don't think that it was safe. Like, I'm sorry. Like, I don't think it was safe.
Right. Well,
I just want to push it home because I do care about the players. I don't want someone to get hurt.
That point,
and someone did get hurt.
I think
Peter Baum got hurt. right?
No, he did. Hopefully he will be better soon. I'm not sure. Do you know the details of that injury, of what
it
happened
to him? It is a hamstring injury. I do not know if it's a tear or if it requires surgery yet. But the result, the immediate result of him getting hurt was that he could not finish the game. And he had two goals.
Right, which that's something we got into that we should talk about
again. Yeah, he...
The implication of that.
Yeah, and that's a big part of it. I think it's funny because I think that if we talk too much about conditions and not about the game, that people will think that I'm like making excuses for Ohio losing or like diminishing the Outlaws' victory, which, you know, I'm definitely not. Like, I'm so convinced that the right team won now. Just going back and not watching the championship game, but watching the 6-game regular season win streak in the semifinal against New York with Denver, so many miraculous things happen. And you can read, I have a 2-part series up on Denver's kind of their personnel moves as well as how they came together as a team during that streak up on Inside the Cross right now. And I think researching that and watching all the games and seeing how Denver reassembled, not even assembled, just like totally blew up and then reassembled their team with young legs to push the tempo and play an exciting style that is prone to both, you know, explosive offense and horrifically like high turnover rate is amazing that they won. Like, so many things went right for them, and you know, they earned those things going right. And I said this earlier, I tweeted this earlier, it got a lot of attention, but it's worth repeating. I think the MVP of the team during the run is Greg Downey. I honestly think, like, everyone, like Jack Kelly had a great number. Everyone has great numbers, right? But if you watch the games, Downing's contributions, I mean, he scores. Downing and Bocklet scored crazy timing goals. Not game-tying goals, not game-like winning goals. Goals that came that stopped other teams' runs, okay? Goals that, I mean, Greg Downing scored the game-tying goal in the championship. Let's not forget that. On a play where he saw an opening and stayed on after a draw. And their faceoff personnel ran off quicker than the Outlaws did. But if you look at the season as a, not even a whole, but that second half where they made that run, you'll see the transition changes. The personnel obviously changes, but the transition and the attack methodology of the Outlaws changes to something so positive and so unyielding. It's like watching the Terminator. I mean, they keep screwing up. They keep throwing away the ball. They did a lot of things, you know, defensively that gave teams wide open shots, and teams did not take advantage of their opportunities against the Outlaws. But also Jack Kelly and the other defenders were great at helping on a lot of broken situations that led to stops or missed shots or adjusted shots. That it's really remarkable how great that team is. And it's funny because, like, I was one of the people, and I'm saying this, and people probably don't remember preseason previews or whatever. I was like, the Outlaws are screwed. They are done. They got no chance. They had no defense.
They were for 8 games. They were bad for 8 games.
They had no defense. They had no defense. They had no real goaltender to speak of any proof after Schwartzman retired. Anthony Kelly left that team and tried to join Ohio and at the end of last year's regular season and was blocked by the league. Because it's they've now since deemed it illegal. By the way, we can talk about league stuff soon. Deemed illegal to set your roster past a certain point. So you have to freeze your roster at a certain point. You can't pick up – someone has to clear waivers from the league. You can't go on waivers after the last game. Like, that's – you can't do that anymore. And that precedent was set last year. So they had – and Dylan Roy's injured. Chris O'Doherty's injured from indoor. You've lost your 2 big defenders, your goaltender, and your faceoff guy. I can't think of a worse thing to happen to a team. Can you?
No. As a former long pole myself, no. I would agree, especially because I think defense is something that scheme and chemistry are and continuity are more important than on offense.
Right.
I think you can reshuffle things and put together, figure something out pretty quickly on offense. But I think defense tends to take more time. And that sort of, that beginning of your training camp and that the time to implement a scheme and work together and get to know each other and know what you're going to do, it makes a bigger difference in the defense.
Right, and the other major point there is that those three positions, defense, goalie, and faceoff, are the hardest positions to play in the professional. It's the biggest jump from college to pro, are those three positions. That's my. Do you feel any differently? Do you agree with that?
No, I think it's a good assessment. I think especially given that you see so many offensive guys just come in and excel right away, whereas you don't always see that on
right.
The
skill set translates much easier than a defensive one, where even in college when you're playing defense, you're the number one pole, and a lot of these guys in the league were number one poles on their college teams. You at least had a switch and didn't play the best guy, or the best guy you played wasn't an All-American every game. You know, even in the ACC in the Big Ten, you still are playing against a guy who's probably not.
And you also had help that if you were covering like an All-American type number one guy, in a lot of cases the guys off ball could shade to you, potentially be there to help you because they weren't covering All-American.
Right,
as well.
And that's the thing about. The crazy thing about Denver's success is the thing they changed is they moved Matt Bocklet low and they stopped using Mike Simon as their stopper and they started playing a lot more sloughed in interior team defense and tried to make teams beat them with passing. You know, they were great against, I mean, Ohio still did it. By the way, that's how Ohio got out to their big leads in the championship game, is they beat the Denver defense with passing. They did, and that's how New York lost. It's because they did not try to beat Denver with passing. They tried to jam the ball down their throats and dodge from their main dodgers in Rabel and Pinnell. And because there was such help on the interior and shutting off the adjacents by the rest of the Denver defense, New York was unable to get the shots that they're accustomed to. Now that was still a close game, and you could argue that Denver really won that because the New York defense was atrocious and took a ton of penalties for no reason. That's a fair criticism. But I think overall the thing that changed for Denver was a team mentality. And I think there's a tendency for people to say that all championship teams are great. I don't believe that. I don't buy that philosophy.
No, some of them get lucky.
Yes. I don't.
Just like anything else. Sometimes people get lucky.
And people are saying that about this Denver team. And let me tell you something. It's not true. This is a great team. This is a great team. This is a team that did not ride stars to win. This is a team that came together to win. And to me, that's what makes you great. Do you know what I mean? That's what makes you one of the teams that should be talked about in the history of the league. And I think this Denver team meets that. I think last year's Lizards team meets that for a different reason. I think it's star-packed. People always cite the 2005 Bayhawks as the most star-packed. I would say that last year with the Lizards, that was the most star-packed team we'll ever see in the MLL.
Also, I think it's worth another – it's sort of a side note, but last year, Greg Renlian's season was far and away – you could argue it's the greatest individual performance in the history of the MLL in terms of a single season. It's without question the best face-off year that anyone has ever had.
Yes.
And if you look at his five-year run of these last five seasons – the four sort of big statistical categories of faceoffs, if you look at ground balls, total faceoff wins, and win percentage, in the last 5 years, he basically put up four of the best eight seasons ever in those three categories.
Right. And
it's incredible.
And he had a down season this year because he played with a broken foot.
Well, he had a down season, but he,
and he was still the
won
best.
The second. No, but he won the second most faceoffs in a single season of anybody ever.
Yeah.
And he had the third most ground balls in the history of the league.
It's incredible. It's
and you're talking about
thing.
This. It was his down year percentage wise, but in terms of, which is weird that he had a broken foot, that you like in terms of just the sheer number of wins in durability and taking all the face-offs every game. It was a great year. It was an all-time. It was one of the, you know, one of the best seasons in face-off in MLO face-off history.
Sure, just MLO history, man. It's only 15 years old. We can save history. It's all good. You know, it's funny. Like, and that's the kind of the point I wanted to make after doing all this research, after watching this team. Admittedly, by the way, not as closely as I probably should have, and a lot of this is in retrospect. But I think you actually have a clearer eye when you look back on season stuff to see who really overachieved and underachieved. I think you have to say that the Outlaws totally overachieved given their talent level compared to what? At least half the league, right? I mean, I think...
Yeah, it's fair.
I think that's fair. And I think that accomplishment is what, you know, we should be focusing on, not really the journey of getting there. The fact that they won it was not lucky. It wasn't Ohio choking. A lot of people have said that too. I think the you could say a lot of stuff about that last goal, though. You could say a lot of things. I'm curious about your thoughts on the winning goal. What are your thoughts?
I mean, I think that was a mistake. Defensively, I think that's one that you look back. I think I forget who it was, the defender that looked like they sort of fell asleep on Eric Law there for a moment.
Yeah,
and I think it's one they definitely want back. I think you tell that Scotty Rogers' reaction in goal, that was not the way he wanted to lose the game.
Oh yeah, and I mean, by the way, talk about guys playing with injuries. Rogers played with a torn meniscus.
Oh yeah, that's another one.
You know.
Yeah, that was which when you think about too the amount of money that they're playing for and the amount of sacrifices they're already making just to take all the time to go fly to the games.
Yeah. It's incredible. It's an incredible thing, and you know, there's this saying, I don't want to get it wrong, but there's this saying by a German philosopher, Wilhelm Steckel, that I always, when I got into the lacrosse industry, this is the thing I always went back to as, you know, something that I wanted to have my life reflect and my contributions to lacrosse reflect. And it's the mark of an immature man is wanting to die for a cause. And the mark of a mature man is to live humbly for a cause. And I think most people in lacrosse that are in lacrosse and all the players know what that means. So if you're listening to this and you don't know what that means, you're probably younger or you're probably older and you're rich and you don't care. But everyone else will know what it means. It's to work for something that you care about so much that money isn't the thing that motivates you is one of the reasons that lacrosse keeps growing. And it's one of the reasons that these players put on such great performances is that they know that that's what they're working for. You know,
I think to get back though, to connect that back to some of the safety issue in the league, the start, I think to a certain extent that almost hurts hurts the growth of the league in a way, because the players sort of are so used to sacrificing so much to play that I think they don't potentially put their foot down about certain things when they should,
right,
to hold the league accountable.
And they totally should, and it's fallen a lot to the media to do that. And it's funny, like, a lot of people will read my stuff and be like, what, you're so hypercritical. You're hypercritical. I don't think I'm hypercritical. I think that I'm more critical of the MLL than anyone has ever been of NCAA lacrosse or any other format of lacrosse, even NLL. When NLL had, you know, NLL hasn't always run as smoothly as it does now, and not arguably, I believe 100% that NLL is much farther along than MLL in player relations by the fact that they even just have a union. But the contention that the players are used to giving it up and won't and continue to do so because they don't have another option. I mean, I don't know if I agree with that. I think that the problem is that the league office still believes that the league is the product that they're selling. And that is patently false. The product is not the ML. You're not selling the logo of the MLL. No one cares. What you're selling, and I made this point on the podcast that you shall never hear, what you're selling is the players and the experience of watching these players play for the team that you choose to root for. And I think one of the dumbest things the league's ever done is to limit the ability of people to see these players play in the games. And by that, I mean not easily accessible on TV. I think there should be, you know, at least a game of the week on a national network. And the fact that that's not happening, the fact the league went in a different direction and went to, you know, basically creating their own channel with LSN and a lacrosse-only channel in general, points to the fact that they don't get that that's still a big part of selling your league is being on TV. I mean, it's inexcusable that a league that used to have teams in Canada, you couldn't watch the championship game in Canada.
Oh, and you have a bunch of more so than probably any other professional sports league outside of the NHL. You have Canadian players,
and you had Canadian. You had a legendary Canadian player playing in what could be his final field game, and you didn't find a way to get Okay, now I'm getting fired up. You couldn't get Canada to watch him. Like, how are they going to watch
him? Much less
now?
The rest of the world.
They can't ever see
much less the rest of the world, which has trouble where there is not. I don't want to say it's in big numbers, but there is demand for high-quality lacrosse broadcasts around the world as you have countries that are starting to play the game.
Absolutely.
And I think you have people willing to pay money for them.
All you people yelling, grow the game, where are you now? Where are you now?
That there was no, even if you had your credit card out, if you're in England or Australia, and you were willing to wake up at whatever time in the middle of the night to watch the game, or early in the morning, or whatever it is, and whatever country you happen to be in, you had your credit card out, you're willing to pay money, there was no way to watch
the game.
And
the league's problems are all rooted in money, and you still couldn't find a way to get people that would have paid money to you to watch your product? It's a problem. Huge problem.
Yeah, also, one of the points, too, I made in the last podcast that I think is worthwhile to make again is my biggest piece of advice for any... And I think it applies beyond lacrosse, but I think it especially applies to a growing sport like lacrosse. And I think in the world that exists now of the internet and social media, the best thing you could do to promote your league is to take the raw video of games. And if you cut it down to clips so people can easily find the goals, the highlights that'd be even more helpful. But just make it all accessible to people so that people can post vines, make YouTube highlight videos, sort of crowdsource the video exposure of your league by allowing anybody who wants to access the video to do whatever they want with it to be able to do so.
Yeah.
And I think that applies. That's a fantastic idea for the United Women's League, the UWLX, to do. I think for any college program looking to get some more publicity is if you just filmed the games and made high-quality film accessible to anybody who wanted to download it, to edit it, put it on Vine, post it on YouTube, you would see all sorts of you'd get all sorts of free publicity by sort of crowdsourcing that to other people.
Yeah, getting your league seen by as many people as possible should be your goal. Period. Yes. End of story. You're a growing league. You're a growing sport.
At this point, it's an investment. You're not trying to make money now. You're trying to grow the value of the league to cash in later down the road.
Right. And they will if they fix things. And I am working on a very long – I believe at this point it's a manifesto on what the league needs to change going into 2017. And I do it pretty much every year.
Is this going to be a yearly manifesto?
No, I've done it every year pretty much. I've done an MLL roundup some years – more, shall we say, heavily edited than others. But I think, you know, and this is not to say that they've only done bad things. This is going to sound like such a small thing, but it was actually a really good step into helping the media that the MLL has really not cared about other than shaping their own message. Prior to this, they hired their own photo service and allowed media to use the photos as free use. To help them you know, get pictures of the league out there. And that has helped my coverage, as well as Chris Rosenthal's coverage, Inside Lacrosse's coverage of the league immensely. Now we don't have to go hunting for a photo for half an hour or like trying to find photographers for every single game. We actually have these photos that we can use and use it to convey a message of the game to the people reading.
It's also, it also just makes sense. It's an economy of scale that there's no reason for everyone who needs MLF photos to pay for their own photographer to go to the game.
Correct. And especially when a fair percentage of the time in the league is spent during the NCAA season where there's zero chance people can afford that. I mean, that's like, oh, I'm gonna send three guys to cover, you know, games in upstate New York, Virginia, and Maryland. And, oh, yeah, I'm also going to cover an MLL game in Florida? No, it doesn't work. It doesn't work. So this is – that was the best thing they did all year. I really think it's the best thing. And it's funny because, like, I'm kind of dancing around the LSN thing. I think the idea of LSN is good. I think that it can't be the only place to watch games, man. It's just it's not fair to the people that are MLL fans, you know. And I think as the year went on, they got a lot better with cutting highlights and posting them for public consumption. I think that actually improved a lot. Social interaction improved a lot.
Yeah, that was one thing that I was disappointed to see. And even if you do, like, in most cases, you're like, it was just taking the LSN footage and posting it on YouTube of the highlights. But to not have highlights of games posted on YouTube after every game.
Yeah.
That not having that was definitely a step backwards.
It's the first year of that. It's the first time anyone's ever tried anything like this with a sport like lacrosse.
Oh yeah, and so. I think it has gotten better, and it's definitely headed in the right direction throughout the year and throughout the season which you expect for the first time you're doing anything.
Right. It's an investment it's like any other company. Right, you can't expect it to make money right off the bat. You know, you gotta put time and effort into it, develop it, nurture it, and I hope that it turns into something really positive for everybody involved and for lacrosse fans in general. I just think that in today's climate with sports, okay, with sports, you need live programming that's accessible on a TV so you can tell the bartender to turn the game on. You know what I mean?
I think that's I think that as well. I think you also need for where the MLL is at, there should be a free game of the week.
Yes, that's basically my point. Yeah.
TV isn't free though. I think having a game on TV should happen. But as well, in addition to that, I think anybody with a computer and an internet connection.
Well, they did that with YouTube, and the quality was terrible. It was terrible.
That's even ESPN3 is fine though. If you knew that, like, every Saturday night at 7 o'clock. There would be one MLL game on ESPN3 that you could go watch.
And there was for the beginning of the season.
Could just become sort of a Saturday night, weekly thing that there's always one free game on ESPN3 that you can tune in to watch.
They should have just made all the Thursday games free. That, like, because that way you're not losing your attendance.
You could even put them on, they could be on LSN. You just have a free, there could be a free MLL game of the week on LSN.
Yeah. And that would drive you to, I mean, it wouldn't drive you. That's kind of their argument would be like, well, we want you to buy LSN. I mean, MLL is our marquee thing that we have to sell. So we're not going to put our marquee item up for free, but they should, because that's the, you know, no shots. It's the best product on your system.
They did. They put it on Paul Riedel's Facebook page.
Oh man. How well did that go? We didn't even, talk about that?
No, I don't think we probably should skip that.
Yeah,
but.
I mean, picking Rochester to do your first game was probably not a good idea, but they did it. It kind of worked. It kind of didn't. It depended on how strong your connection was with the internet. But I think before we get a little too negative, I think it's time to tease out what we're working on for maybe a little farther down the road that maybe a couple people have heard about. We talked about it on Twitter a little bit, and that's my team of under 5'9 MLL players versus a team that you construct of players over 6'3.
Yeah, constructing. We should explain it started. It started with you. You wanted as a proud. How tall are
5'7".
You? 5'7". Okay. Yes. As a proud under 5'9 person, you wanted to represent the successes of your fellow under 5'9"
players.
With an all sort of an all MLL 5'9" under 5'9".
Correct.
And I think the defensive captained by Denver's own BJ Grills.
Yes. Who I didn't get a chance to actually talk to after the game. It was tough. Everybody kind of scattered. But he would have been perfect to get one. When the Outlaws won, I should explain this. When the Outlaws won 2 years ago, Anthony Kelly, I thought he didn't know like who I was. So he was like, "Hey man, you want a picture?" Yeah. I think he thought I was a fan on the field. I was like, "No, dude, I'm like here to interview." He's like, no, I know who you are. We're getting a picture." And that picture is actually on my Instagram. And he is comically large next to me, who is comically small.
Yes, he's the faceoff. I believe is the only option at faceoff for the over six foot three and
yes.
Over team.
So my contention was, well, if I'm going to get that picture, I should probably get one with BJ Grill. But I looked around and he was gone before I could get one. Just as like a fun kind of contrasting thing. You know, I've always been there was actually a pretty well-regarded article about athletes in Boston that are like all under like 6 feet tall in the Boston Globe that came out like right around MLL Championship that I've retweeted a bunch of times. You should go check that out. And how Boston like really accepts, you know, the tryhards, the triers, the skill players, the guys that are undersized, the underdogs, that I really enjoyed, that also inspired this kind of idea. So,
and especially though, I did look up the average height for an American male is only 5'10".
Right.
So really, even an under 5'9" team, there's a lot of guys on that team who are only slightly shorter than average.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's funny. Like I tell people I'm 5'7", they're like, "No, dude, you're like 5'3". I'm like, "No, my head is really big and I'm really stocky, so I look like I'm a lot shorter than I am. But I'm actually 5'7". Like,
yes, no, that's a fair point.
Everyone calls me like a midget. I'm like, actually, I'm 8 inches away from being a midget. Because if you're under 5 feet tall, technically you can be a midget and get like a handicap sticker. Don't ask me how I know that, but I know that. At least in my state. I don't know if you can do that everywhere else, but you can do that here.
But anyway, so it started with that, and then you proposed that I should come up with, obviously, the logical team for the under 5'9 team to play against, which is the 6'3 and over team.
Yes.
And I am not that tall. I am a little bit taller than 6'1". So, for purposes of the podcast, I represent the taller than average.
Yes.
Players.
And I think,
but no, I think it's gonna be fun. I think the plan is to publish the team maybe, and we'll each maybe write a short synopsis of why our team would
win. Yes, totally fair.
And then we'll ask people to vote.
We'll put a poll up, and I will put that link to the Boston Globe article in the show notes for people that are listening to this on iTunes. One last thing we want to close out with the.
Oh, no, for mentioning stuff we've been working on, I also want to shout out to myself for my Vine reposting Twitter bots.
Yes.
You should follow
them. Guys, Patrick has robots.
I did make robots.
He has robots.
To do my work for me. They just randomly pick my Vines and tweet them.
What are we going to do?
And I made three. I made three of them. There's one that posts three times a day, like morning, afternoon, and evening, to kind of give you just a dab of lacrosse vines in your Twitter feed. There's one that posts every hour in case you really just need lacrosse vines in your Twitter feed all the time. And I also made one which is fitting that I started it today on what Twitter tells me is it's Women's Equality Day, which I didn't know was a thing, but apparently it's today.
It's every day, Pat. It's every day.
That's why I didn't know it was a day today. But I also have a women's only one since my Vine selection in terms of the clips I turn into Vines is so biased towards men's lacrosse that I went through and, it's one that was just repost. We'll repost a couple of women's Vines every day.
Guys, he's making robots. What are we going to do?
For real.
Are you whispering now about me?
No, no, never mind. So one last thing to close out with on my end, we're going to circle back to gear real quick. I had a chance to talk to the designers and marketing team for New Balance Lacrosse's new cleat, the Freeze. And we're going to attach that to the end here as a closer. Real quick, just talking about the technology and the development of that cleat that also launched at MLL Championship Weekend. You can find it now in an all-white colorway. New colorways will come out in September. I wrote a review of the cleat that's going to be in the next issue of Inside Lacrosse. It's awesome. It's everything that you want in a lacrosse cleat that you never knew that you wanted because you've never actually played with a lacrosse cleat. You've just played in redesigned football cleats. So check that out.
Which actually, before you post, can I get your – do you have a take on that, on how – how much different is a lacrosse cleat than a redesigned football cleat?
The biggest difference insofar as using this cleat that I have experienced from any other cleat, and I'm a, as I've said before, I'm a shoe head. I'm also a cleat head. I've tried every brand that's out there, every style, soccer, football, even rugby a couple times. The thing that is different on these Freeze cleats is the ability to stop laterally and explode laterally. And yes, that's important in football cleats, but the way I explained it kind of to someone asking me about the cleat previously is football is a game of going forward. Football is you're always pushing towards a goal that's forward behind you. Lacrosse is not that goal, not that game. Lacrosse has a lot more cutting, a lot more circuitous movement.
Yes, I mean, dodging from X is essentially it's a horizontal, it's a side-to-side
right.
thing.
And these cleats, I mean, they're not going to make you better. Don't get me wrong. I love them, but they're not going to make you better. But what they will do is give you an unparalleled level of feel for the ground. So like what people that wear basketball shoes kind of refer to as court feel, you'll get unmatched turf or field feel with these cleats. And also underrated thing that I read about briefly in my review is they're comfortable. I played in bare feet with these because I was late to my first plastic game because I got stuck on the bridge and I forgot my socks in my car and the game was already happening. So I had no choice but to play in bare feet, and I would never do that with any other pair of cleats. But because I'd had some, you know, comfort wearing these and some experience with them in my summer league, I was like, I think I'll be okay. And I was. I had no blisters or anything, so they're a great cleat. Okay, so I am, again, Kyle Devitt, lifestyle and gear editor for Inside Lacrosse. You can find me on Twitter at The Kyle Devitt, THEKYLEDEVITTE, as well as Instagram.
I am Patrick McEwen, a.k.a. The Lax Film Room Guy, and you can follow me on Twitter and Snapchat at Lax Film Room, or on Instagram at Lacrosse Film Room, all spelled out. That's also on YouTube by that same name.
Awesome.
Anyways, we're headed out. We'll play that interview, but catch us next week, guys.
Thanks.
Bye.
Thanks for listening. All right, this is Kyle Devitt from Inside Lacrosse. We are talking about the Freeze cleat. Why don't you guys introduce yourselves?
Sean Kellogg, product manager for New Balance Lacrosse.
Zach Schreier, brand manager, New Balance Lacrosse.
So by the time this goes up, you guys will have seen this cleat, and if you've been watching the MLL season, you've already seen this cleat on the feet of many MLL players. It's kind of a interesting strategy to bring in a new piece of equipment into the lacrosse industry. Sort of unbranded. Why don't you guys talk about that experience, putting that together?
Yeah, I mean, it really came out of what New Balance Soccer did when they launched their new soccer cleat. They did a whiteout squad and a blackout squad with unbranded pairs of cleats, and it's really, it went over really well with people picking it up and asking the question, what is it? So we wanted to take that and do the same sort of strategy there and really try to see if kids would start, you know, talking about the product before we even really announced that we were in the game of lacrosse. So that's where we came up with the idea. We did the all white and really just took the logo off and let the silhouette speak for itself.
Yeah, and it just really allows us to get it, you know, player validation, but it allows us to actually collect some marketing assets before a launch. So when we do get it out in the field, we can kind of point it out to kids and remind them that they've actually already seen it without realizing they've seen it.
There was a thing on Instagram, somebody who thought it was called the beta. They're trying to get their hands on it. People are trying to guessing about what it is. And it's actually a very organic way of generating that kind of buzz. I think that, like, industry people are
are probably interested in seeing how it develops.
Yeah, it's garnered a lot of attention. I mean, it was kind of nice when we saw the kid call it the Beta Cleat, because obviously the overall always in beta tagline that the New Balance brand has been using obviously is resonating or is being recognized by these kids. And a lot of them have been pretty sharp and figured out early on what that cleat really was and what it's going to be.
So it's a really radical design, the plate especially, but also, you know, going to a one-piece upper almost. Very revolutionary in cleats alone, not just lacrosse cleats. And I know you guys worked hard to make this be the first lacrosse-specific cleat. Just kind of talk about that process that you went through.
Yeah, I mean, it was a really cool process because it was something out of the ordinary for us as well. Typically, when we work on new projects, we have our design and development team and myself working on the projects. This time, we were able to pull in the New Balance Cleated Innovation Team and the New Balance Sports Research Lab and really tap into a lot more data-driven stuff that really we haven't been able to do in the past. So with those two new groups on board, we actually extended our working time to about 24 to 30 months out, and to give them more time to work on the plate and the data behind the product itself. So working with the Cleated Innovation Team and the Sports Research Lab, we're able to really, you know, pass off, give them an idea of what we wanted to solve for and let them go and come up with possible solutions. And they came back to the table with this really aggressive looking plate. And honestly, the first time I saw it, I was like, wow, that's aggressive. I'm not sure if we should push it that far. But once, you know, our inline designer tied the upper to it and sort of told the total story, it really is something that worked all together for us.
I think it's a really good visual example of what the benefits are of us transitioning the Warrior footwear and apparel over to New Balance lacrosse. All the kind of resourcing that New Balance extends to us, plus their expertise just in footwear in general, I think we would have been hard-pressed to come up with something this revolutionary under the Warrior handle. And the New Balance has just been great for the brand.
And you guys kind of seeded this cleat early with a bunch of college teams for the 2016 season, as well as the obvious MLL guys that are using it. What was the initial feedback from, like, first impressions of those guys?
I mean, it started with getting in the buy-in from the coaching staffs first. I mean, we really wanted to be able to test, you know, a new product in a really aggressive cleated outsole with these teams to get real-time feedback. So really showing the coaches, and once we showed them, they knew right ahead it was going to give them sort of that little bit of advantage on field with those guys having more traction. So they were on board from the get-go. And then we sort of did a product walkthrough with each of the teams that would be wearing it and sort of showed them the product and really didn't want to put any sort of idea or notion in their head, good, bad, or indifferent, and let them sort of talk through what they like to get their initial feedbacks on the product. And overall, it was really great because the whole New Balance being new and basically a lot of things that were right off that guy's heads were, this is not what I was expecting. This is really cool looking. Something that's really different, really fast looking. And, of course, the traction story with the bottom. So we had an immediate buy-in, really, from the guys that were wearing it. And as you said it before, it's like on some of the social posts, we've had some of the kids that have worn it already this season in NCAA on commenting, on saying, hey, you know, I wore those this season and whatnot. So we've had a really good response from those guys just going out and actively saying, yeah, I wore it, best cleats I've ever worn.
And this cleat is launching MLL Championship Weekend, Kennesaw, Georgia, August
20th is the championship game. We'll have some teasers coming out that people would have seen by now, starting around the 15th, and then newbalance.com/lacrosse will be live in conjunction with the MLL Championship. The all-white limited edition colorway that we came out with will be on field for that game. We will be selling those on site. We'll have an experience with our freeze van. We'll be there along with kind of the warp fitting and everything in the fan zone. But a big splash for us in the kind of official launch of New Balance lacrosse.
Awesome. Anything else you guys want to add before we take off?
No, all good here.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, guys, thanks for tuning in. This is the gear section of the as-yet-unnamed Kyle and Patrick podcast. Check out the freeze cleat, and we'll check you guys out later.